Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. The nation of Ireland holds the European Union's rotating presidency until June of this year. As such, the country's officials play a key role in implementing EU policy, from addressing the Eurozone debt crisis to developing new trade opportunities to addressing foreign affairs like turmoil in Syria. Ireland's ambassador to the United States can offer some unique insights on these and other matters, and that's why His Excellency Ambassador Michael Collins will come to the University of Illinois on Friday for the European Union Center's 12th annual EU Day, where he will deliver what is characterized as the State of the European Union address here on campus. It's also why we thought it would be appropriate to speak with him today about some of these issues, as well as to discuss the relationship between the U.S. and Ireland, and to learn a little bit more about the life of an ambassador. Michael Collins has worked in Ireland's government, in the Department of Foreign Affairs, in its headquarters, and its embassies in Rome and Washington, in the Consulate General's Office in New York. He's been an ambassador to Saudi Arabia and nearby nations, the Czech Republic and Ukraine. He's been involved in the Northern Ireland peace process. And since 2007, he has served as Ireland's ambassador to the United States. And now he has to endure talking with me for an hour. Ambassador Collins, welcome to Focus.
Yes, good morning, Craig. How are you?
Well, thank you. Thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome.
And as we begin our discussion, we welcome your questions and comments for His Excellency Ambassador Michael Collins at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or comment on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either site at Focus580. It is not every day I talk with someone who is referred to formally as His Excellency. Does it take some getting used to that sort of formality?
Well, I don't know if we're much involved in formality. I mean, in the end of the day, we have a job to do. We obviously have the distinction and the privilege of being representing our country here. So, you know, people assign the title of His Excellency or whatever. But to be honest with you, I mean, day-to-day life involves just obviously doing the job, representing one's country here, and obviously doing it to the best of one's ability. But it's a big privilege, and obviously to have the title of ambassador alone is an extraordinary, as a privilege for me, and has been while I've served in that capacity, both in Saudi Arabia and also in the Czech Republic.
And I want to talk some more about the experience of being an ambassador in a little while, but I'm also thrilled to have you on the program because there are several subjects that I think are worth discussing. Let's start with the Eurozone debt crisis. How would you characterize economic conditions these days in Ireland and in Europe as a whole?
Well, you know, I mean, I would say in the case of Ireland, I mean, obviously Ireland has been the center of a great amount of attention, more so than we would ever would have imagined following the crisis that befell us back in 2008. When our country hit the buffers and when we had to manage a very, very difficult situation. And we were at the heart at that stage of the European debt crisis, the European crisis as it was so called. Now, if in Ireland's case, we have been working our way out through this. We've had to get some assistance in so doing, of course. We were part of a bailout program since 2011. So it's been a very, very difficult period for Ireland as a country, for the people of Ireland, to manage this traumatic decline in our fortunes. Because, as you know, for a period of nearly 15 years, Ireland grew exponentially. But then we hit the perfect storm, or imperfect storm, if I may put it like that, back in 2008, and obviously we've had to make serious adjustments. Our storm was brought about, obviously, by the situation of our banks, by a property bubble, and of course this had implications for some of our partners around Europe as well. But the good news is, having experienced 3 years of just really very, very challenging circumstances, our country has stabilized, our economy having declined by almost 11%. From 2008 to 2011. This year, and again next year, we're expecting to grow. Obviously, we'd like to be growing a little bit stronger, but we've certainly stabilized and we're growing again, and that's the good news. Overall, in Europe, obviously, again, I mean, you know, there's a different story depending on where you're looking at it from. If you're looking at it from the perspective of a country like, you know, Finland or Germany, you might see it one way. If you're looking at it from the perspective of a country like Greece or Portugal, you might look at it from a different perspective. So there are mixed circumstances. But Europe is getting its act together, I think. It's come through itself a very bumpy ride in terms of trying to find solutions to the banking crisis, in particular the debt crisis. But I think you will have seen last week that we succeeded in agreeing a budget through 7 years from 2014 to 2020, which is no small achievement. And I think it's an indication that Europe is capable of acting, Europe is capable of adjusting, but there's more work to be done, a lot more work to be done, both in the case of Ireland and also across the Union as a whole.
As you mentioned, the EU leaders last week agreed to a 3% cut in that 2014 to 2020 budget. That is the first time such a multi-year budget has been cut.
That's correct.
What is your reaction to that agreement beyond the fact that it indicates that there is some measure of coalescing among nations that may have disparate points of view and disparate circumstances?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, just bear in mind, I mean, the complexity, both either in domestic terms of reaching agreement on a budget is a challenging thing. You know, try reaching an agreement on a budget among 27, you know, rather diverse countries, you know, from the west coast of Ireland to the corners of Russia and from the North Pole almost down to the Mediterranean. It's a very, very challenging business. Yes, there was a cut, but it certainly was a high priority for the Irish presidency to ensure that the budget was achieved during our semester as presidency of the union. So that in itself is a good thing. Obviously, there are conflicting views as to how much money the union would require for the seven-year period, but we've come up with a figure in around the trillion mark that did involve trillion euro mark that did involve a cut of about 3%. I think most countries, and certainly our own country, which is the beneficiary and continues to be a beneficiary of European funding, thinks that we can manage our circumstances within the budget that's now been agreed. But of course, we also have to assure the agreement of the European Parliament, which is the next step, because it's one thing for the executive of the European Union to agree it, as it has. There's another step now required since the Lisbon Agreement, which is that the European Parliament must agree it. But we're obviously hopeful, and we're certainly determined to achieve that agreement too.
You mentioned what a challenge it is to get all of the member states of the European Union to agree to a budget. And I sit here thinking to myself, well, here in the United States, we are but one nation, and we can't agree on a budget.
Well, I wasn't wishing to draw comparisons, but you've just done so. But, I mean, in any event, the point is, you know, of course, the European people need to also bear in mind that, of course, a trillion-dollar budget of the European Union, which the budget comprises over the seven-year period, is only about 1% of the budget of the economy of Europe, as were the revenues of Europe. So, in other words, the European Union is a vital part of what we do and what we are. But the actual budget in the context of the overall European economy, obviously, is but a small percentage. But we're very, very glad that it's been agreed. Europe needs stability. Europe needs certainty. Europe needs to be able to demonstrate that it can achieve outcomes, because, you know, a lot of people have criticized the union over the last 3 years about, you know, in terms of the halting response to the crisis, to the debt crisis. I think the budget agreement last week is a good indication, a very good indication that European leaders can get their act together, even if obviously everybody didn't come at it from the same direction in terms of whether there should be cuts or whether there shouldn't be cuts. In the end of the day, there was an agreement, and that's obviously an important point. And obviously, at the end of the day, people could rally around the deal as was presented by Mr. Van Rompuy.
Now, at the heart of debates over the last year or more associated with, well, really, I guess the last 3 years associated with economic policy in Europe seems to have placed various players in two camps. One seeking continued austerity cuts to bring spending and benefits in some nations under control. The other seeking ways to invest in order to stimulate economic growth. And it is sort of the same debate we've been having here in the States. Do you see parallels between what the EU has been going through and what the U.S. is going through?
Well, you know, I mean, again, each country does come at this thing from different directions, but I think we all recognize, certainly those countries within the European Union that share the currency, of whom there are 17, the euro currency, of whom there are 17, including Ireland, that we must reach, we must maintain our commitment to a 3% budget deficit. So I think, obviously, our figures had, and the figures of other countries had gone out of kilter. You know, we're in the process of adjustment to bring our figure in terms of budget deficit down to 3%. That has to be the common goal of members of the euro area. But I mean, I think it's interesting that this debate, whether it's in Europe or whether it's in America, it does tend to break down as to whether we can involve austerity or whether stimulus. Obviously, the ideal situation is the situation that I suppose we'd all like to see ourselves in is being able to probably do both. In other words, make the cuts that we have to make, but also stimulate the economy. In our particular case, I mean, in Ireland's particular case, we didn't have too many options. You know, obviously we ran into problems in terms of our own ability to raise money. You know, so we've had to engage in quite a significant amount of austerity, and really we haven't had a huge amount of choice in that matter. So, but the good news is there that in Ireland's case, we've achieved 85% of the consolidation that's required. In other words, 85% of the adjustment that's required to bring our budget into shape has been achieved, and we're well on our way to achieving the 100% target by 2015. But each country has its own capacity, but obviously money is very, very tight, and a lot of people kind of associate Ireland with kind of having made the level of success that we've had through austerity. But there has been a certain amount of stimulus there as well. But the stimulus amount that we would have at our disposal is obviously very, very limited.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is the Irish ambassador to the United States, Michael Collins. He is coming to the University of Illinois on Friday to participate in the European Union Center's 12th annual EU Day, where he will deliver the EU Day's State of the European Union address. We welcome your questions for Ambassador Collins at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your comments or questions on Facebook or Twitter. We are on both sites at Focus 580. And we welcome other questions and comments, of course, again at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We have an email from Angus. He notes that the University of Illinois is a global leader in the development of technology. He says Ireland has been a location for growth of technology companies, and he wants to know what you believe is the current status of technology manufacturing in Ireland.
Well, Craig, it's actually very strong. I mean, with despite all the downside and kind of the negative messages that have been kind of around there for the last while, I mean, our inward investment pipeline has been really, really quite impressive. And in fact, I see a recent figure out that no less than one third of all Irish exports now are in the high tech end of things. I mean, people kind of associate Ireland with agriculture and all the rest. And of course, we are a strong agricultural country. But at this stage, agriculture in Ireland comprises maybe 2-3% of our economy. That doesn't make it small. It just means that our economy has grown hugely. But a key ingredient in our economy today is technology. So if I tell you that the three leading industries in Ireland at the moment, one is pharma and biopharma. Second is ICT, and third are financial services. They are the three drivers of our economy at the moment. And obviously, the whole question of research, technology, innovation is key to what we've been about. It's key to our success. And despite the fact that, I say, we've had this downturn, that's been mainly associated with our indigenous banking and property, there's another side of the economy which continues to do very well. And in fact, we've just regained record growth in our export levels, a lot of which is driven by ICT, and a lot of that is driven by inward investment from the United States. Because, the Ireland as a destination for inward investment, a lot of it high-tech, Ireland has attracted something in the region cumulatively of about $200 billion of U.S. investment, which is more than U.S. investment combined in China, Russia, India, and Brazil. So it gives you an idea of just the scale of it. And I say most of that is around the high-tech area, ICT, that kind of stuff, pharmaceuticals. And that's obviously something that's a great success story that sometimes gets obscured when people talk about the banking crisis, which has been the center of our particular problem.
Do you see a role for academia like the University of Illinois when it comes to working with the nation of Ireland to advance the economies of Ireland and the United States?
Well, of course we do, and also not just the economy of Ireland, but more broadly, obviously, the whole question of just the interconnection with Europe. I mean, we just applaud the fact that the university gives this devotes this attention to Europe. Europe is a story which is not so easily told in this country. People don't fully appreciate just what it is that we're trying to achieve in Europe. In fact, over the last 2 years, we've had a job even convincing people that the European project, the European Union, was indeed going to survive, and so was our currency. But a lot of people out there, I think, to the extent that they had any appreciation of Europe, I think they felt that Europe was destined absolutely to fail, which, of course, it's not. So anything that stimulates and encourages and promotes an awareness of this extraordinary relationship that the United States has with Europe, and within that, of course, with Ireland. I mean, between the two of us, Europe, that is, and the United States, we generate about 50% of global GDP. 50% of global economic activity is generated by these two economic areas. So to the extent that the university can generate an appreciation of all of that and of that relationship and of the importance of the European Union, both as an economic entity and as a political enterprise, I think that's all to the good. And within that, obviously, Ireland does well as well. But we really, the story of Ireland is somewhat better understood in this country. I mean, obviously, we have no real difficulty, given the unique relationship that we have between Ireland and the United States, of telling the Irish story, because we have a huge cohort of people out there, 40 million expatriates of one type or another with Irish antecedents. And around St. Patrick's Day, I think that figure goes up to 100 million or so, people who would aspire to being Irish. But the key point about it is we have a great story to tell in terms of that particular relationship, but also we're interested in telling the relationship between more broadly between the United States and Europe as a whole.
You mentioned the currency, the euro. Why is it an advantage to have this one currency over the system that we had 20 years ago when each European nation operated with their own form of currency? What is the ultimate advantage?
Well, I mean, allowing for the fact that clearly, and we have acknowledged that flaws were made in the design of the currency, which have come back, and that need to be corrected. You can just imagine a situation in the United States if you were going from Illinois to Kentucky and from Kentucky to Pennsylvania, and you had to change a currency, or you had to do a currency transaction at each time you crossed the border, or each time your goods crossed the border. That obviously would be a big inhibition, a big inhibitor to trade. So in Europe, obviously, we have the single market, which comprises all 27 countries. And then within that, we have the 17 countries that comprise the euro. For us, most of our business, obviously, is done within the European market space. And to have the opportunity to trade in a single currency has been a huge advantage to us, allowing for the fact that, of course, there have been elements in the design of that which now need to be corrected. But it has been a huge stimulus and a huge facilitator of trade. And for Ireland, we need to trade. We need to trade comprehensively. We export almost every single thing that we produce. In fact, we export, I'm not quite sure if I can explain the statistic, but we actually export more than 100% of our GDP. So to be able to trade into an area, a currency union, which shares a currency, allowing for the fact that not everybody, of course, our next-door neighbour, Britain, does not have the currency. That's another story, of course. But it's a huge facilitator of trade, and we trade, and we prosper by trade, and the currency is a big, big help to us in achieving our ambition to even trade to an even a greater level.
You mentioned that there have been some discussions, some pundits, some who have analyzed the situation and said, well, there may be some EU nations that may not want to continue to be in the EU, that there could be some fragmentation over time. British Prime Minister David Cameron recently gave a speech in which he stated that within 5 years, if his party remains in power, they would hold a referendum on whether Britain should remain or leave the EU.
Mm-hmm.
Do you take that seriously, and what would happen if they were to leave?
Well, I mean, he has painted a rather lengthy horizon. I mean, I think he's painted an horizon which brings them through the next election and brings them to, I think, the idea of a referendum, I think, in 2017, which, given what Europe has been through in the last 3 years, I mean, that seems like an awful long time away. But in general, obviously, I think the ambition of the Union would be to hold all our member states, all 27 member states, and shortly to be 28, when Croatia accedes, hopefully later this year. And certainly from our point of view, our view very strongly is that we need Britain in Europe, we need a strong Britain in Europe, and certainly just in terms of our bilateral relationship, the relationship between ourselves and Britain, which is so crucial to us, we are all the better off if Britain remains a strong player in that European Union. Now, Mr. Cameron obviously has set himself a challenge of repositioning himself within that union. It remains to be seen how all of that evolves. There is some time yet, but certainly our ultimate desire would be for a strong Britain in a strong Europe, and certainly in terms of our bilateral relationship, to ensure that Britain's position in Europe is assured in the future.
Do I infer correctly that what you're saying is if the Prime Minister had made such remarks but said, I promise this will come to a referendum next year, that would be a much bigger deal than...
Well, I think you'd have that would be an extraordinary challenge, I think, for him to set himself. And, of course, he didn't do that. And I think, in fairness to him also, I think he did say that his ambition was to have Britain remain in Europe. In other words, that he would seek to achieve an outcome which assures that particular situation. And obviously, I think a lot of the European partners, obviously, they do value Britain's contribution, both and Britain's voice. And I think also, you would have seen that the United States, I think, issued or made it very clear statement to that effect as well, that a strong Britain and a strong Europe was very much in the interest of the United States as well. So let's just hope that evolves and that Europe evolves in a way that assures its full existing membership, and that everybody is within a union that they can feel is strong, that it represents the interest of Europe as a whole, and that obviously is destined to succeed way into the future.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is His Excellency Ambassador Michael Collins. He is the Irish Ambassador to the United States, and he will be on the campus of the University of Illinois this Friday for the European Union Center's EU Day. He will be giving their State of the European Union address. We are discussing not just the EU, but Ireland's relationship with the United States, its relationship within the EU, and later in the hour we'll talk a little bit about the life of an ambassador. We welcome your questions and comments for Ambassador Collins at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either at Focus 580. Those phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we'll go to Paul in Champaign County. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. I can't help but comment on your storied name.
Mine are Craig's.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, Craig is a long and storied.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Okay. I wanted to ask about previous policy, the harmonization upward sort of policy, which was the opposite of austerity imposition. And a lot of people, when they talk about Ireland, they talk about how much it gained from the EU in the past. And when people talk about the crash, they mainly talk about the housing bubble. But yeah, it seems to me that the policies open to business, sort of low tax policies for corporations, and not taking advantage of the harmonization money to actually strengthen the state in some ways, and instead of this policy, which people argue was necessary to get companies to move there, but I don't think that's entirely true, because the population is well educated and the computer programmers are excellent there, and it wouldn't have been necessary to have done that, and I think the Irish state would be in much better shape if that policy had been pursued. But we don't hear that argument much. But on the banking crisis in Ireland, I wonder whether I was there when the Nordic revival was going on, the reclaiming Ireland's Nordic heritage. And it seems to me that if you could look further to the periphery and see what Iceland has done about their crisis, it seems that there are a lot of lessons to be learned, and their bankers went to jail and things like that. And I think it's a better policy than here and in the EU generally. I guess I'll hang up and listen. And thanks for letting me contribute.
All right. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you. Let me just address some of those issues. There are a lot of issues within there. I mean, Ireland has gained enormously from our membership of the European Union. I mean, when Ireland joined the European Union 40 years ago, in January, Ireland was a country that was economically weak. We are now, despite the fact that, as I say, we've gone through this trauma, Ireland still, relatively speaking, is now a relatively wealthy country. In fact, I saw recently, I think it was a Forbes analysis that had Ireland, in terms of GDP per capita, despite everything, still as the 13th or 14th wealthiest countries in the world. So Ireland, in terms of just the upward harmonization, I think you refer to, has been a huge beneficiary of European policies in terms of just programs that have allowed our economy to develop and allowed us to reposition our economy, obviously continue to grow our agriculture, but more particularly to grow everything else besides, particularly in the high-tech area that I referred to earlier on. And we do offer a low corporate tax rate. Our corporate tax rate is 12.5%, which, as you rightly say, Paul, is only one reason why people would come to Ireland. But that's actually, but it's still nonetheless a very important factor in attracting people to our country. 12.5% rate for all corporate taxation is really, really attractive. And I think, and obviously it's at the discretion of any other country to have whatever corporate tax rate it wants to have. Our industrial policy is based on a tax rate of that. I think, generally speaking, what happened in Ireland was really centred around the housing bubble, as you described, and the banking crisis that was in and around that. The other aspect of our economy in terms of our industrial production, our industrial performance, has actually, you know, continued to do very, very well. And in fact, all of the most of the inward investors who came to Ireland over the years, they have all remained with us throughout this period of particular challenge. And in fact, our pipeline in terms of attracting new inward investment is still very, very strong. Obviously, we have to recalibrate. We have to make this repositioning work that I just said to you earlier on. We've achieved about 85% of the consolidation that we need to do in terms of getting our economy and our fiscal situation straight. But our problem really was a banking problem. It wasn't a kind of an industrial policy problem centered around the tax rate or anything else. Sometimes people do make the comparison between Iceland and Ireland. You know, obviously, in due course, people can write the story perhaps more fully about, you know, the track that our respective countries took and are taking in terms of exiting from the challenges that we have. We believe that we are going to exit from our bailout program, which we entered in 2011, hopefully later on this year, and that we'll be back in the bond market, and that Ireland is going to emerge from this also a country that's at least 20% more competitive than we were when we started this crisis in 2008. So all of those things are going to position us very, very well for the future. In fact, some of the measures that we've had to take over the last 3 years are perhaps measures that other countries are only beginning to have to take now. So we do think that we're going to have a little bit of a head start. It's been very painful, but we do believe that as the economy, you know, swings back into growth again, and as the global economy hopefully will swing into growth as well, that Ireland is going to do particularly well and is well positioned to take advantage of all of that. But as I say, we hope, but Europe has been very much part of the reason why Ireland has gained the success that it has. And we believe, and we are without unambiguously, you know, determined in terms of our devotion to the European project. Ireland is an unambiguous, devoted member and committed member of the European Union. We believe in the Union. We believe in staying at the heart of the European Union. And we believe that a strong Union is not just good for Europe as a whole, but it's good for Ireland in particular.
To that end, Ireland currently holds the presidency of the EU. What does that mean? What impact does that have on Ireland's role in the European Union?
Well, you know, the presidency, the last time we held the presidency of the European Union was 2004. And in fact, I was involved in that at that stage in Ireland. And that was at the time, in May 2004, when the big expansion of the European Union took place to bring in all those countries from Eastern Europe in particular. But of course, the nature of the presidency has since changed since the Lisbon Agreement of a few years ago. So the rotating presidency has evolved in a somewhat different way. For example, you know, there are now new institutional arrangements in place for the chairing of the European Council. For example, the president of the European Council is Mr. Van Rompuy. And also, you know, I mean, we have a fully designated and professional body, you know, looking after Europe's foreign policy interests. So in some respects, the presidency has evolved. But still, it gives the presidency, in this case Ireland, for the 6 months that we're there, an opportunity to really to prioritize, I suppose, and to assure the smooth functioning of the Union, alongside, of course, the big institutions that are there that run the Union on a day-to-day basis, including the European Commission. But it gives us a chance also to step into the limelight, I suppose. Ireland has gone through a rather traumatic period, to be honest with you, as I just tried to describe to you. We do believe that we, throughout that trauma and period of challenge, we did suffer some reputational loss in terms of what happened to our country. So to be able to step out confidently and to help direct the traffic, the political traffic, the economic traffic in Europe for the 6 months that we're in charge is a big challenge, but also a very big opportunity to demonstrate our European credentials and also just to regain some of the footing that we fear we lost during the period when our economy was going through such trauma.
So if you are able to some degree influence the agenda or help to set it, what then is the agenda for the EU between now and June?
Well, I mean, obviously, a big part of that agenda between, you know, for us was the achievement of the EU's budget. You know, again, no mean achievement. That was a carryover from the last semester. But it fell to us to play our part in ensuring agreement on that for the last. Last week as we achieved in Brussels. But you know, the agenda for us, obviously, over the coming period is really going to be, centered on what we regard the three areas of stability, jobs and growth, right? So, I mean, I think it'd be, given what's happening in Europe, given what's happening in Ireland, it shouldn't come as any surprise that they should be the focus of our attention, stability, jobs and growth, and the focus of Europe's attention. So in all respects, we are trying to channel our energies into progress in all of those three fronts. And key to all of that, and a key priority, and it gets rather technical, is the whole question of banking union within the European Union. Obviously, those countries who form part of the currency have determined that we need to tighten up our banking arrangements, to achieve a form of banking union, and to get the European Stability Mechanism up and running.
Well, what does tighten up banking arrangements mean?
It means that, for example, that the crisis that we've had, not least in Ireland, in terms of our banking, can never revisit us again. So it gets obviously rather technical in terms of what we need to do, and that's obviously a work in progress. And in fact, the European finance ministers had an opportunity to discuss it again yesterday. But a lot of our problems are centred on our banks, and I say we in Ireland, you should know particularly well, just the consequences of a banking system that doesn't work. So given the fact that all of these, what the banks do, affect not only our own local economy in terms of Ireland or any of the other countries, but now have pan-European effects in terms of when banking goes wrong. It's not surprising that we should be looking at the banking system and making sure that we have facilities and arrangements in the future should there be future problems there in terms of banks failing, big banks failing in particular. And I think that's the centre of a lot of activity at the moment. Obviously, it gets very, very technical. It involves the European Central Bank as well. But, I mean, again, it really is the flavour of the moment, what we do in terms of the stability mechanism and the banking arrangements, and how we, in fact, would involve ourselves in bailing out banking issues that arise in the future.
I want to talk some more about Ireland itself and your role as an ambassador. But before we leave the EU behind, as you noted, the EU, of course, plays a significant role in foreign affairs, including in the Middle East, where you served as an ambassador back in the 90s. The EU in recent months toughened economic sanctions against Iran over its nuclear program. Of course, the U.S. has been pushing this as well. Are those sanctions working?
Well, we believe they are. I mean, sanctions, we believe, are obviously the vehicle that we have to pursue. We would rather, obviously, that we saw more progress on the political front. But, we have worked very, very closely with our United States colleagues. And I think that's one area where it's a classic demonstration, if I may say so, of where the European Union and the United States can work in solidarity together to try and achieve the greatest possible effect from these sanctions. So I think, when people talk about, the union and that type of thing, I think its activity, particularly in partnership with the United States in the area of Iran, is one particularly good example where working together can make a difference. But obviously, we need to make a bigger difference and achieve the outcomes that we want to achieve. I should just say so, just in case we omit to do so, when we were talking about the union as a whole and the relationship with the United States, one of the things that we do want to achieve, obviously, and to see the beginning of negotiations on, is a new European free trade or new free trade agreement between the United States and Europe. And we hope in the coming days that we may see announcements which will at least begin the process of negotiation of such a free trade agreement, because we do believe that a free trade agreement between the United States and Europe can stimulate both our respective economies and make a big difference for jobs, growth and stability in our respective locations.
How would such an agreement change the process? I mean, right now, generally speaking, trade would seem to be relatively free between the U.S. and Europe, would it
yes,
not?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, trade at the moment, I mean, I think some of the tariffs, I mean, really only comprise, formally at least, something in the region of about maybe 3% or thereabouts. So, but, the combined trade between our two countries is something in the region of $700 or $800 billion. So I think any reduction, I mean, even if the barriers are low, any reduction in those barriers can actually make a difference. And, of course, I appreciate also there are lots of non-tariff issues which have to be addressed and which are complicated. I'm not trying to minimize just the challenge that would be involved in seeking an agreement. But I think there's a general estimate out there that with an agreement, however achieved and when achieved, it could have the capacity to add 1 or 2% to our GDPs in our respective jurisdictions, which, of course, would make a considerable difference. So I think it also would be just a demonstration of a kind of a new kind of energy in the relationship between Europe and the United States. I think sometimes there was a concern, maybe misplaced, that there was kind of a pivot towards Asia, maybe to the exclusion of Europe. As I say, maybe misplaced, but I think this would give a really retool the relationship, bring it into new focus, and obviously at the end of the day, with agreement, be a significant stimulus and stimulant to our respective economies.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is the Irish ambassador to the United States, Michael Collins. He's coming to the University of Illinois Friday to participate in the European Union Center's 12th annual EU Day, where he will deliver the EU Day's State of the European Union address. We are discussing a wide range of issues related to the EU and Ireland, and we will talk in just a few minutes about what it's like to be an ambassador and what that life is like. We welcome your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your comments or questions on Facebook or Twitter. We're on both sites at Focus 580. And we will have more after a short break. This is Focus.
If you love Downton Abbey, you're probably dreading the conclusion of Season 3 on February 17th. Cheer up! Make a gift to WILL-TV and receive two tickets to see the Season 3 finale on the big screen in our studio at Campbell Hall at the University of Illinois on Sunday, February 17th. We'll have food, beverages, and prizes, and you can discuss and speculate with other fans. To learn more or to register, call Stacy Rudolph at 217-333-7300.
Today's programming is made possible by Parkland College Theater, presenting the classic American comedy, You Can't Take It With You, by Kaufman and Hart, from February 21st through March 3rd. Can Alice and Tony's love survive when the conservative Kirbys visit the free-spirited Sycamores for dinner?
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking today with His Excellency Ambassador Michael Collins. He is the Irish ambassador to the United States, and he will be on the campus of the University of Illinois this Friday to give the European Union Center's EU Day State of the European Union address. We are discussing not just the EU and Ireland and its relationship with the U.S., but also when we get into what it's like to be an ambassador. Our guest has been one not just to the United States, but also to Saudi Arabia, the Czech Republic, and other nations. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. So what is it like to be an ambassador? Can you take us through a typical day?
Well, first of all, it's Craig. It's an extraordinary privilege to be an ambassador. I mean, I've had the privilege of being representing my country at ambassador level in Saudi Arabia, and indeed all the countries in the Gulf, in the Czech Republic and Ukraine, and here in the United States as well. But if I may say so, you know, all of those other locations were very special in their own way. But to be, you know, Ireland's ambassador to the United States is something extra special again. I mean, we have such a privileged, special relationship. Unique relationship, we'd like to say, with the United States, that to be here representing all of that and seeking to bolster it in every way I can, it clearly is something that I am deeply grateful to have been given the opportunity to do so. The thing about the job, of course, is you never quite know what your day is going to bring, and you never quite there's no one ordinary day. All I would say is that, you know, the day really is not well defined in terms of 9 to 5, because it's not a 9 to 5 job. The job, obviously, is wherever it takes you. I mean, so, for example, today, apart from the opportunity to speak to you just before you came in the door, came on the phone, I was talking about to people here about a particular opportunity for investment in Ireland. And later on today, you know, we'll go to the State of the Union address. And again, we get, as ambassadors, we get the have an opportunity to sit in the chamber, to sit in the Congress tonight, and to listen to the President of the United States. For me, that'll be my sixth occasion as ambassador, because I've been here 6 years to do that. So it's, again, something very, very special. So that's a very, very big day. Tomorrow then, or the day after tomorrow, I'm heading for Boston for a conference where I'll be speaking on the issue of science and innovation. And then, of course, I'm heading your way to Champaign-Urbana, and then on to Chicago to speak there on Saturday night. So the job is not defined in terms of days of the week, or less so, again, in terms of hours of the day. You know, obviously, you're in the business of articulating and representing your country as strongly as you can. and not in any way that would cause that would mislead people, but just to ensure that people are as well informed as we possibly can, and to ensure that there's a level of interest, whether from the point of view of tourism, whether from the point of view of inward investment, whether from the point of view of our vocation as a member of the European Union, that people understand that, and that they have a sense of the modern Ireland as well, the Ireland that obviously is a very strong and very, very proud place, but also a place that clearly and particularly values its relationship with the United States in general, but also with our very, very large diaspora here, who comprise something in the region of, as I said earlier on, like 40 million people, which is an extraordinary link. And the challenge that we have is to ensure that we protect and preserve that link into the future.
You mentioned that you will be attending the State of the Union address tonight. That will be the sixth time you've done so. It occurs to me that there's a lot of analysis leading up to the address here in the United States. There's a lot of post-speech analysis, all from the point of view of Americans looking at what the president said and what it means for policies for the U.S. going forward.
Yes.
I'm curious what about the event or what about the speech itself interests you from your perspective? Are there certain cues that you listen for, certain subjects that you're thinking, boy, I wonder if he's going to bring this up, that might be different from what Americans might look at and think about leading up to a speech like this?
Well, you know, as you say, there's plenty of pre-analysis and certainly plenty of post-analysis. And a lot of that, you know, some of that is obviously, we pay attention to it all, but some would be perhaps of greater interest than others. I mean, we would be particularly interested tonight, and I'm not sure he's going to do so, I mean, but there's been a certain amount of speculation that he might indeed refer to the European Union, United States free trade agreement possibilities. Obviously, we'd very much welcome that if it were there, that it would be profiled in that particular way. But I can't presume that he's going to do so, although I've seen some speculation in some quarters that he may do so. But if he doesn't do it tonight, obviously we would hope that we would get agreement soon to start those negotiations. But I think we would, most particularly, I think what we are interested in is how and whether the U.S. economy is going to recover fully and is going to, because what happens here fundamentally, I mean, it affects everybody in the world, what happens in the United States, but it particularly affects us. We're a country, the United States is our biggest single export market, but also, as I just mentioned to you, we're a huge destination for inward investment from the United States, and we're a significant contributor to foreign direct investment into the United States. In fact, I think we're the 13th largest inward investors into the United States, which is very significant for a small country. But I think the key thing are the messages in around the economy, because if America's growing, you know, and growing strongly, obviously that's a huge advantage to Ireland. And particularly as we're pulling out of our trauma and as our economy is growing again, it's clearly vital that the people with whom we do business, and particularly with the United States and particularly with the European Union, that they begin and grow strongly as well. So the messages on the economy obviously are clearly of particular interest to us. But everything that the President of the United States, the calibration that he gives to that messaging, you know, how he says it at the State of the Union, is analysed very, very carefully, and people take careful note of it. I also had the privilege to have been at the inauguration, and people, you know, do see the two speeches kind of in tandem. In any event, it's a very, very substantial platform, and all the world basically is listening to what the president has to say, and more particularly how he says it, how he calibrates it.
It occurs to me it must be especially challenging for you to serve as the Irish ambassador to the United States. You have to take into account Ireland and U.S. relations, but also the U.S. relationship with the EU, Ireland's role within the EU, individual nations in Europe and how you relate to them. How do you juggle all of that? Or do you just concern yourself with, I represent Ireland and everything else is set aside?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm here. My mandate is to represent Ireland. That's the job of my job as ambassador, to represent Ireland in every way I can. But I mean, obviously, Ireland lives in a world, in a European world as well. So, and in this particular period, it gives us an opportunity to articulate our European credentials as well, which are very, very important to Ireland, as I've been explaining in the course of the program. But fundamentally, what I'm about here is the relationship, about the about ensuring that we have a relationship with the United States which is as strong and as unique as it has always been. Next month we have St. Patrick's Day, which again is an extraordinary outpouring of affection for Ireland, I would say, and our Taoiseach, our Prime Minister, would be here. He'd be in the White House. He'd be with the President. He'd be on Capitol Hill. He'd be with the Speaker. And again, it's just an extraordinary opportunity for us to kind of fly the Irish flag. But in flying the Irish flag during the 6 months, we also do fly the European flag as well. And looking out my window here, I do see the European, in the embassy here, I do see the European and the Irish flag flying side by side. But as I say, so in this particular period, obviously, we do articulate the European agenda as well as best we can. But my fundamental responsibility here, my fundamental obligation here is to ensure, and to assure the relationship with the United States and also with our wider community here. And our community in Illinois as well, because we have a fantastic resource here, a fantastic linkage here, which few other countries have. And as I say, our challenge, to some extent, is how to capture all of that in a way that's meaningful for today and more particularly for tomorrow. In other words, how do we maintain this link into the future, this extraordinary link which has served us so very, very well.
Have you always been interested in government service in I mean, you've been playing a variety of roles, not just as an ambassador, but I ticked off the list earlier, going back to the 1970s. So has just this sort of been sort of key to your whole life?
Well, this has been my life. I've done nearly 40 years of this, most of it in the Foreign Service, as you say. I've been in the Foreign Service since 1974, which is, so it's getting long, I've been there quite a while. So this is my life, and it tends to be also, it very much is your life because, I mean, you live it in ways that are obvious. I mean, you travel, you live in different countries, and you educate your children in different countries. So it becomes such a big part of what you are. And it almost comes to, I suppose, to define you in so many ways. The thing is, I suppose, as you reach the end of your career, you know, leaving it all behind eventually when the time comes would be a very, very big problem because it is a kind of a job, a very privileged job that you live. You live and you devote yourself to, whether serving in Ireland or when serving overseas. So it's something that is I've had the privilege of doing for 35, 40 years now. I can't imagine myself ever having done anything else. It's just been an extraordinary trip and career that's taken me, as you say, from Rome to Saudi Arabia to New York to Washington to the Czech Republic and indeed back again here to Washington. And, I just valued the opportunity to have been able to, serve my country in this particular way and to be given the opportunity to in more recent years, to do it at the level of ambassador.
It just occurred to me, of course, you served in the embassy, the Irish embassy in Rome. I imagine you maybe have some thoughts or reactions to the big news yesterday that Pope Benedict is going to step down, the first pope to essentially resign in, 600 years, 700 years, something like that?
Well, indeed, what an extraordinary day. I mean, waking up here yesterday morning and to switch on, to connect with the news that was the announcement that the Pope had made. And, of course, it's an announcement which had global impact. I mean, the reach and the connection of the Catholic Church globally is enormous.
And I imagine in Ireland in particular.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and so, I mean, we obviously will obviously it's a quick turnaround by, in terms of just the Pope resigning with the effect from the end of the month and there being a succession plans in place to pick a successor. So we simply obviously and wish the Pope, Pope Benedict, the very best and those involved in choosing his successor obviously have a very, very large responsibility and I'd say we wish them well.
Finally, we have just a minute or so left. What are, maybe you could name one challenge or maybe a couple of challenges that face Ireland internally that maybe we here in the United States do not know about or do not think about?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think most of our challenges are pretty well writ large. They are to do with the economy. It's the economy, the economy, the economy. But I wouldn't want to minimize those at all. I mean, as we're getting there, we've stabilized, we're growing again. But I think one of the During the period of the boom, I think we did attract to our country a lot of new people. I mean, so at one stage, I think our workforce was comprised, certainly at the height of the boom, was comprised of maybe 10 to 15% who were non-originally Irish people, people from Poland, from Eastern Europe in particular. Some of whom have returned to Poland in particular, because Poland tends to be the destination where the largest number came from, and all came, of course, legally as members of the European Union. So I would say maybe one of the things, and some of whom have returned to Poland, as Poland has done so very well in recent years. So one of the challenges, but many have remained behind. So we have a whole new community there of new people, and just that challenge of properly integrating the new Irish, as we might refer to them, into our infrastructure, into our educational system, and for their future in Ireland to be part of an inclusive society is something that maybe people you wouldn't fully appreciate just how from an homogenous society of 99% Catholic, 99% as it were Indigenous Irish, to a society which has become much more multi-ethnic and much more multi-religious, if I may say so too. That is a challenge that maybe is there that people don't fully, on the outside at least, recognise as being there. But it's one that obviously we have to try and to the very best of our ability to get right, to integrate all of these new people who have come to Ireland to contribute to our economy, to integrate them in a way that's meaningful and that gives them a stake in our future as a country.
Michael Collins has worked in Ireland's government and the Department of Foreign Affairs and its headquarters and its embassies in Rome and Washington, in the Consulate General's office in New York. He's been an ambassador to Saudi Arabia and nearby nations, the Czech Republic and Ukraine. He's been involved in the Northern Ireland peace process, and since 2007, he has served as Ireland's ambassador to the United States. Ambassador Collins, thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're very welcome. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you.
And we welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. A reminder, our usual rebroadcast of Focus at 8 p.m. will be preempted tonight so that we can bring you live coverage of the State of the Union Address from NPR. That's at 8 o'clock tonight on AM 580. On tomorrow's program, we'll talk with Charles Whelan, author of the new book, Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from the Data. That's on tomorrow's show. Today's show is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen.